Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. She's the infidel your imam warned you about, and there's no holding her back as she shares her opinions, insights, information, and outrage discussing the political entity known as Islam. We are at a critical juncture in our history, and if the threat of Islam is not faced up front, right now, then we will lose the freedoms of individuality, civic justice, and autonomy of thought we rightly enjoy, and instead see our values replaced with kinetic and civilizational jihad, Sharia law, and oppression permanently. Don't let the memory of our soldiers, past and present, go in vain. It is up to us to protect the legacy for which they fought so hard. We have an obligation to honor their memory today and for future generations. Join Kel Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern and Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Blog Talk Radio. But leave your political correctness well away from her phone lines and chat room. And be warned, Kel takes no prisoners.
GoDamnMedia.com.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger. I'm your humble host, Kel Fritzy, and there's very little I have to explain to you for whom my guest is tonight. I am very, very proud to have Major Montgomery J. Granger retired as my guest tonight. He is and was one of the keepers of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay starting in 2002. He wrote this wonderful book, Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay. Major Mudd, this man is a true patriot. He's not only a soldier and a patriot, however, he is a husband and he is a father. I read this book, and I was so moved by it that, being the usual red fox that I am, chased him down. I said, please come on my show and talk to my listeners. He is graciously lending his time to do so. I'm not going to keep him any further. With that, I am more than happy to introduce to you Montgomery Granger. Before I do that, though. Okay, enough of that. Monty, hello, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great after hearing that music. That's actually the theme song to my favorite show.
I know. It's wonderful to have you here. Now, explain, what inspired, first of all, I don't want to give you the same old tired questions, but I have probably about 40 here, and I don't have you for too long, mm-hmm. but what inspired you to write this book? Like, when I was reading it, I was getting the impression that there were a lot of people out there that didn't really understand what Gitmo or Get Me More Bay was all about. People had a lot of misconceptions about what Gitmo Bay was, what the purpose of Gitmo Bay was deemed to do. There were a lot of people very upset about the plush treatment of the detainees. Mm-hmm. I spoke with you on Daria's program there last month, and mm-hmm. I was one of the callers spouting my indignation about how well they were treated. You came up with a great explanation for that, though.
Yeah, it was to keep them fat and happy, makes them less dangerous to themselves and to the guards, and that's the number one concern, is that everyone stays safe and secure. That also makes them more pliable. If we calmly and, dignity, tell them that, hey, you're here, you're going to stay here for the rest of your life unless you cooperate. And everything you do and say leads them to believe that. That's very important, because otherwise they'll wait us out. Otherwise they'll pull tricks. Otherwise they'll self-starve and cause trouble because they think they're going to get out. But once they believe they're not going to get out mm-hmm. until they tell us what we want to know, then it becomes a very safe situation.
That is something as well that I want to ask you, is that, yeah, when they came in, they were pretty thin, and they were referred to as carrot sticks, and keeping them fat and happy makes them a little more compliant, so I can understand that. There's a lot of Americans
right.
and so on that don't understand things like $700,000 soccer fields. They don't understand that. But after reading your book, I began to have a deeper appreciation of what I would consider the humanitarian tactics of the U.S. military and how they deal with their detainees, because unlike a lot of regimes, which, of course, the American military is not, there are regimes out there that would shoot a soldier between the eyes as opposed to bring him in and treat him well and send him back home. I was reading when I was reading your book, you had a quote there from Germany. The soldiers, the military brass during World War II, they were rather unhappy mm-hmm. with that. You didn't even follow your own handbook. You kind of went along as you did. But you had to understand that things change and things develop, and you had to come up with tactics in order to deal with this new entity, this new enemy that we're dealing with today. And sometimes falling off the handbook is the best policy ever. That's what I understand. That's what I think.
Well, I think, you know, to answer that, I have to back up a little bit, because there are really two missions that go on in a military incarceration, especially one of this nature, where they're not just lawful combatant prisoners of war waiting for the end of the war and then be released. For most of the detainees, it should have been a lot different, because the real reason that they were even kept alive and brought to the United States or to the Guantanamo Bay is for mm-hmm. questioning. So my part of the mission was simply to keep them safe and healthy, treat them with dignity and respect, so that the other side of the mission, or the intelligence side, could do their job. So we really didn't have direct contact, other than my boss, the camp commandant, direct contact with the intelligence command at Guantanamo Bay. Later, they combined the command, but it was clear at all times who was really in charge of what was going on and who was calling the shots, and that is the intel guys. So we were pretty much jailers and had our mission, and then the intel guys had their mission.
That's something else that it seemed that at points there were a lot of mixed messages as to how to approach the detainees, and just referring back to that this was a phenomena that the U.S. military had never really seen before. Islamic terror is quite different from dealing with people who are military combatants that follow Geneva Convention. I think this was pretty much the first foray that we had with enemy combatants that absolutely did not follow the Geneva Convention. So how to balance that? Because they were not really technically allowed the benefits of the Geneva Conventions, but how to get around that and treat them all the same, right down to their food, their dietary needs, their prayer needs, their paraphernalia, prayer needs. For example, I was reading in the book that they would be issued surgical masks so that they could use them as a little hammock in order to place the Quran so it wouldn't touch the floor.
That's correct.
Deference that these prisoners received. However, they weren't always the nicest people. They were very difficult people to deal with all the same. One in particular sticks out with me, and that is Wild Bill, and that is Abdul Razak. It was pretty much determined that he was actually he would be considered clinically insane. He made life a living hell, though, for the handlers of the detainees over there.
Yes, he did, and I guess at some point everyone felt that he was no longer a danger to the United States of America, nor was he of any intelligence value. So therefore, it was decided that he would be released. And during that release journey, we took a break before delivering him to the aircraft that would take him back to Afghanistan, and that's when he talked to us through an interpreter about how he was captured, what he was doing. He was basically picked up an AK-47 with the Taliban, who agreed to continue his heroin addiction. So some of the bizarre behavior could have been attributed to his withdrawal symptoms, but also was diagnosed as a schizophrenic at the time. So you have a couple of those in there, and one was released recently to go back, but I would argue that unless they're an extreme case, they should never have been released. I mean, we've sent home over 600 detainees from Guantanamo Bay, and not one of them was executed or beheaded or hacked to death or blown up or dragged naked and lifeless through the streets, so you know, which is pretty much what they would do to us if they could get their hands on us. And that currently, Kelly, is pretty stupid, because there's a documented over 28% combined recidivism rate amongst released Gitmo detainees, in killing, you know, including Sufyan bin Kumu, the alleged leader of the Benghazi attack. So it's not very smart to let these guys go, because it's pretty much letting them get back into the fight, which is self-defeating.
That's what I understand, too, is that one in seven detainees released, they return to the terror cause, as it were. I don't know what some of these detainees did upon release. I know that there's been a lot of issue as to what to do with them, and President Hussein Obama and him wanting to shut down Guantanamo. Well, what do we do with the current detainees if they're determined to be a high risk, even at this point? do we put them in American prisons, or do we entrust our so-called technical allies to take them back and imprison them so that they are no longer a menace?
Yeah, it's kind of a quandary, but I tell you what, there are groups out there who are sympathetic to these guys who, you know, want us to believe that they're simply goat herders. But there's a Human Rights First group out there, and you can look that up at humanrightsfirst.org. And they brag that federal civilian criminal courts have convicted nearly 500 individuals on terrorism-related charges since 9/11. They also say that federal prisons hold more than 300 individuals convicted of terrorism-related offenses, but they don't mention what happened to the other nearly 200 convicted terrorists. Are we supposed to assume they're free on American soil? And if they're prosecuted and convicted, the guy that's over here now, Alibi, would he be set free someday on Main Street USA? I mean, these are the things you have to think about before prosecuting a war criminal in a civilian court of law. You can convict them all day long, but what's the sentence? When do they get out? What is their right to appeal? And when they get out, do they walk the streets? It's the last place we want them.
And, you know, of course, the reaction of the American people, yeah.
Right. I mean, if we were broadcasting now to every American, I think there'd be pitchforks and torches in the streets around the White House saying, are you kidding me? you put our lives at risk because you want to be politically correct?
We don't want them here. That's the general consensus, and that's a civilian consensus, a military, governmental. But maybe they understand a little bit more. But I also understand too that there were a lot of inside infighting as to how exactly to treat the detainees. The one approach to keep them fat and happy, but there were a lot that wanted to see Clockwork Orange-like rehabs. Take place, rehabilitation. There were a lot of different opinions within, either it be the CIA or the Pentagon or whatever. There was a lot of internal struggles as to exactly what to do with these detainees. And, of course, they're detainees. They're not prisoner of wars. They're detainees.
Correct. And you know, we had that same question, but Donald Rumsfeld, who was down there and spoke with my boss directly, said that we know that they're not entitled to the protections of the Geneva Conventions because they broke the law of war by not wearing uniforms or carrying arms openly and et cetera. However, the decision was made at the highest level to treat them within the spirit of Geneva. And what that told us as jailers was that we would treat them as if they were prisoners of war, with some exceptions. In other words, a prisoner of war, there's a hierarchy. They're allowed to work for pay. They're allowed to have a canteen, which is, you know, like a small store. These were the worst of the worst in 2002. They were all brought to us from a prison riot over in Afghanistan that killed Johnny Michael Spann, the first American killed, who was a CIA operative working in the prison at the time. And as these guys got off the plane and were in process, it was very clear to me that these were war wounded. You had a lot of people who were wounded. You had some limbs missing. You had some pretty extreme cases who took a lot of medical care. But that was the consensus, that these were to be treated within the Geneva Conventions. And I think the simple reason, Kelly, is we didn't know how to do it any way else. That's all we were trained to do, is the right way.
Do you think Guantanamo has been successful, or are you worried about Abdul Razak, like you mentioned? He probably was just some sort of stoner and probably got caught up in something to feed his habit. But you were also dealing with very dangerous men, and David Hicks of Australia, of course, comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
You were dealing with very hardcore detainees that were very coherent, very, very deliberate in their thought, and very determined that they would not be so-called brainwashed. And David Hicks, I believe he was the he's a convert. Obviously, I'm obviously I've heard of him, and I don't know what his Islamic name is, but I know that his Christian name is David Hicks. So,
mm-hmm.
But
yeah, he
when
had
you're
converted
dealing, like,
to
yeah.
Islam, and then mm-hmm. converted back once he got to Gitmo.
Oh, how convenient is that, eh?
Yeah.
I want to ask you something. You're a teacher. You're an educator.
Mm-hmm.
You joined the Army Reserve as a way of furthering your education. Did it ever occur to you that you would spend 2 years at Guantanamo Bay? Did it ever occur to you that you would go overseas to fight the Taliban over there as well? Did it ever occur to you, or did you think that you would be maybe a weekend Army reservist, that like a lot of men and women think is what the reserves is? I think it came as a shock to a lot of people when they joined the reserves that we're getting deployed.
Yeah, I think there's initial shock with everyone, but I'll tell you what, everyone is trained as a soldier first. And
mm-hmm.
when I went through basic training in the mid-'80s, 86, 87 was my training years, they were focused on the Ayatollah Khomeini and the danger from Iran. They had us believing we were going to go to war the next day, every day. So they
mm-hmm.
prepared our mindset for it. So every reservist, every National Guardsman is actually trained just the same way active duty soldiers are trained, and they put it into your head, whether you're a cook or a clerk or a medic, you're always a soldier first, and they train you to fight just as any other soldier would train to fight. However, that doesn't really take away the shock and awe and surprise when, as we say in the military, the balloon goes up and there's a war. And that happened with the first Gulf War. I was with the medical unit in Manhattan at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And leading up to that, we were told that it was going to be a long, drawn-out, bloody war. And we were training up. We're getting our trucks painted desert camouflage, getting measured in size for desert camouflage uniforms. And then after 10 days, it was over. So, you know, the shock and awe came next on 9/11 when I think I'm like you and everyone else, when one plane hits the World Trade Center, you think it was, you know, maybe somebody had a heart attack in a small plane.
I thought it was, I thought the same thing as everybody else. Yeah, just an accident.
I think, right, so when two hit it, we kind of collectively probably thought it was bad guys doing that to us. And we went into our reserve centers, and I remember doing that on 9/11 and seeing my colleagues, many of whom worked in the city, coming in like deer in headlights because they had seen people jumping from the towers. They had been through that atrocity. And those images and those experiences are burned into their memories forever. And if you're an American who experienced it that up close and personal, or new people who experienced it that up close and personal, we're still in a global war on terror.
Mm-hmm.
The bad guys
are
still out there, and it kills us that we keep letting them go so they can come back into the fight.
It brings me back to that issue, the Clockwork Orange style rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was interesting in the book that you mentioned that do we sit them down literally and show them over and over and over again the images of the World Trade Centers and people jumping out of the buildings from hundreds of stories up as opposed to being burnt alive? Do we replay the images of the Pentagon in Shanksville, Pennsylvania? Is that one approach? That's one approach I know that people wanted to take. But I don't know, would that, if we did that, that would border on torture.
Yeah, it wouldn't be legal. I don't know if it would be torture or not, but it'd certainly be abusive and certainly not our mission. It's not something we'd be trained to do. That came out of frustration and anger, which comes out, I guess, several times in the book because, you know, we would talk about things like that, and it would help relieve the stress. We did call them carrots. We called Camp X-Ray the garden to help us deal with the day-in, day-out situations there. Soldiers, like I guess anyone at their workplace, will make light of a bad situation and try to deal with it in that way. But the mission was clearly not incarceration for punishment, so it wasn't a penal situation. It was not a corrections situation that we thought that these guys were ever going to leave there until the global war on terror was over. And I think you asked me previously what I think of the mission now. It's more or less like a rest and recreation place for Al-Qaeda and Taliban. And you can't really argue that it's anything else except for the few who are there on charges of war crimes. There are some there who are cleared for release but can't go back to their nation of origin because their nation of origin isn't stable enough. And then there are those who are there because even though they may have a place to go back to, they're deemed too dangerous to do so, but cannot be prosecuted under the Military Commissions Act of 2009. The Military Commissions Act of 2009, which are the governing principles right now for the war crimes trials, were devised by the Obama administration and are currently give the detainee who might be accused of a war crime the same rights as you and I would enjoy in a federal court of law, and it's simply absurd. It's completely and totally absurd. Back in 1942, there were 8 dry-foot German saboteurs who were captured on American soil. 2 of the 8 turned on the other 6. Now, I want to remind you, Kelly, that nobody was hurt. No property was damaged by these saboteurs. Yet in less than 4 weeks, 6 of those German saboteurs were tried by military commissions, denied habeas corpus by the President of the United States, which by Constitution he may do, and were executed. They didn't hurt anybody. They didn't kill anybody. They didn't blow anything up, yet they were executed under the laws of war. And those laws of war applied to this situation but have not been applied.
And that was what I was glossing as well. And it's your book touches on that. But I've read a lot of articles about that. A lot of these were hapless farmers that were caught up in a dragnet. And when they were ultimately returned to Afghanistan primarily, they were killed by their own government because they were seen as being in working with the United States government, and so they were therefore not to be trusted, and therefore they were killed, or their family members were killed, their children were killed. This was a very terrifying event for a lot of Afghani people, simple civilians that never wanted anything to do with the Taliban. However, they just got caught up in it as well, and it's a game of who do you trust. It could almost be a game show. Spin the wheel, and where you land, that's your fate.
Yes, war is a nasty thing. And, you know, nobody wants to get caught up in it. But, you know, things happen beyond your control. And the history of this nation, the history of all nations, really, is wrapped around war. It's wrapped around death and dying and killing. And if you look back just to our Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was a self-taught attorney. He was also a self-taught general. When he knew he was going to be president, he gathered all the books from West Point and studied them and was very patient with his generals. But after a couple years of war, understood that the generals who were in charge of his army were not going to win it for him. So he found Ulysses S. Grant and he found William Tecumseh Sherman, who perpetrated total war on the enemy. And, you know, even Lincoln himself, when he tossed aside habeas corpus for civilians and held military commissions for civilians and was vilified for that by his enemies, likened the limb of the Constitution could be amputated to save the body, which was the Union. And that is a kind of chilling statement, but he valued the Union even above the Constitution because he knew without the Union, the Constitution would be meaningless anyway. So when we go to war, we should go to war for total war to win the war and not to give up halfway through and say, well, you know, you can go back and it's okay and still suffer things like we have in Boston and Fort Hood and Benghazi and other mm-hmm. places around the United States and the world. We are at war.
And there's no end in sight as far as I can tell. I want to touch on something, though. That is something I would really like to explore. But I know that at Guantanamo Bay, they took a real hit because of what happened at Abu Ghraib, the abuses in 2004, and that pretty mm-hmm. much sealed the deal. And a lot of minds that, well, the military, they can't be trusted with dealing with detainees, that they are just going to have at it on their own. And that very much hurt the mission of the United States military on how to deal with the detainees that they catch.
Yeah, it was really disappointing. I actually was in Iraq at Abu Ghraib after the scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And those at Abu Ghraib during the scandal were my brigade, and I got to talk with them a lot about it, actually. And what the average civilian doesn't realize is, again, that split mission. There's a jailer mission and an intel mission. Well, at Abu Ghraib, it got grayed. The lines were grayed. These folks who were initially exposed as being part of it were actually the jailers, and their job really was to take the detainees from point A to point B, and that's it. They really weren't supposed to take part in any of the interrogations. They're not
mm-hmm.
trained to do that. And these folks from a National Guard unit in Maryland were not trained even for their incarceration mission. They're just run-of-the-mill military police. So not being specially trained and not being necessarily indoctrinated into what the other mission was, the intel mission, they were convinced by the intel folks, who very few have been prosecuted or punished for that, to do certain things that were abusive to detainees. And even though that represents probably less than 0.1% of all the MPs in the United States Army, I can assure you that 99.9% of them perform their duties to the very highest of professional standards on a 24/7, 365 basis. So
I can agree.
It was a wake-up call, but it was, you know, not representative of all of us.
There were a lot of things going on at that time, too. For goodness sake, a lot of this started taking place. You were deployed in 2002 to Guantanamo Bay. And after being deployed overseas, you've done three tours. People will have to understand that. And so you saw a lot more than most people would, of course. There was also a lot of infighting. I touched on the issue of what do we do, how do we interrogate, and we do not interrogate, we interview. And they're not prisoners, they're detainees. There was a lot of issue
right.
over that, right down to the terminology. And when I was reading the book, I came across this, and I'm sorry, Monty. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, just to let you know, Major, oh, this is so funny. The Major, he said, he gave me permission to call him Monty because I asked him, can I call you Monty? Is that okay?
Oh, sure.
But,
yeah.
But Monty, when I was reading the book, there was this one entry in it, and it was just a complicated political mess, it would seem sometimes,
mm-hmm.
including right down to date of rank. I was reading that. It's like, well, I was ranked first. Well, I was ranked at 10 a.m. You were ranked at 2 p.m., so I have a rank. Right.
That's
down
true.
To things like that.
That's
that
true.
Would make the mission much more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you know, some of us find that comforting. And if you ever saw The Hurt Locker,
I have.
You know, mm-hmm. anachronisms aside, you remember the scene when he came back and he's in the supermarket And he can't really handle the things at home. I mean, we can all relate to that because the military life is such a simple life. It's dangerous and dirty as hell, but it's simple. You don't have to think about what you're going to wear, where you're going to go, what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Once you're in country and in a war zone, you can get blown up at any time. And so really you have to mourn your death.
Yeah.
You have to mourn the death of this person that you knew before you went into a war zone to be able to cope
mm-hmm.
in that war zone. And military people like things simple, direct. And in the Army, we have a saying, and that is there's a regulation for everything. And if there's not, then your commander can tell you what to do. And that's a comforting thing when there's always a regulation to look up, always something that's going to help you decide, you know, what the next course of action is going to take.
I have you probably for 10 minutes. When I was reading your book, you wrote something, and it's near the beginning, and I was reading it, and I'm thinking, wow, this is coming from a seasoned military officer. You know us civilians. Here, I'm just going to tee it up for you and let you expand on it. Is that,
mm-hmm.
as you know, we always hear, bring the troops home, bring the troops home.
Mm-hmm.
We hear that a lot all the time, and I'm in that camp. I'm always espousing that, let Allah deal with it. Just bring our men and women home and let them deal with it over there. But we cannot.
No.
You said
the ship
that
has
no
sailed.
Soldiers. you said that soldiers don't quit the missions; they accomplish it.
That's right.
And that moved me.
If you bring us home, we can't finish the job. And
yeah.
that's frustrating. It's frustrating about Iraq because I knew before the president ended that mission that was the wrong thing to do. We still have troops in Germany, Japan, and Italy, for crying out loud, countries we defeated
mm-hmm.
68 years ago. And there's a reason for that, and the reason is power projection. If you want someone who's a neighbor of yours to do your bidding, you better not move away, because once you move away, someone else will come in and influence that neighbor. And that's what we've seen in the Middle East. We gave
Brilliant.
Up the high ground. We gave up the high ground in the global war on terror. And every single person who served in Iraq, I'll bet you if you asked them, did we leave too soon? Should we have left? 99% of them will say absolutely not. We had a mission to complete, and here we are in 70 countries around the world, Kelly. And why
mm-hmm.
are we there? We're there because the ship has sailed on isolationism back in World War I. Woodrow Wilson got elected as an isolationist and yet became a war president because he understood that if he stood back and allowed the forces of evil to overtake our friends in Europe, that we would absolutely be next. And so we can't sit by and watch things happen and dominoes fall, even if you can talk about Vietnam all you want. But there were political reasons why the Army was not allowed to win that war. And there's almost always a political reason why the military is not allowed to win, because the military seeks victory. We don't seek to occupy or take over a culture. If you look at Germany, Japan, and Italy, they're some of the most prosperous, peaceful countries on the planet for 68 years, and the reason why is we are still there. Last spring, very quietly, though, Obama sent home the last of our Abrams A2 tanks from Germany. So who got all full of himself right away? Mr. Putin did. When we left Iraq, Iran and Russia and Al-Qaeda were very quick to reinfiltrate. So that's a mess over there. In Syria, you haven't heard about Syria because of our financial challenges, but I guarantee you.
Yeah, that's going on, yeah.
The more we walk away from it, the worse it's going to get.
And the more that we will be ill-prepared once again. I don't know if we're ill-prepared. I know a lot of people who say that, well, we should have known better. Something else that you talk about in the book is that you've been having conversations, and you had a conversation with a person named Dennis in particular, and how he felt about the blame game going on, and Bush's foreign policy and American policy, and the another thing that affected our effectiveness was the right sizing of intelligence. That the CIA and the FBI, they were not communicating, and they were not listening to the Islamic chatter.
Right. It put us in a very vulnerable situation. And if nothing else, you have to maintain the tip of the spear in any conflict. And the tip of the spear, Kelly, is always what we don't hear about. It's the clandestine operations. We call them secret squirrels or shadow warriors. But these people are the ones that really keep us safe at night. These are the ones putting their life on the line every day, just like our hometown firefighters and police officers and EMS workers. These are the real heroes of the military and the CIA, et cetera. And, you know, you have to keep that strong. You have to keep the investments going. It may take 10 years to develop the adequate human intelligence that you need to prevent an attack, and that is all the training, all the you know, language training and combat training, et cetera, that goes into just one individual is a huge investment in time and material and money. And to just wipe out programs out of hand was a very dangerous thing that some of our administrations did, and it takes years to build that back up. And if nothing else, we need to keep those strong. But we also need to keep our place in the world. We need to stay in the 70 countries we're in. We need to maintain our friendships. We want people to think if you're the friend of the United States, you don't have a better friend. But we also want them to think if you're the enemy of the United States, you don't have a worse enemy.
How do you feel about things today? You're back in civilian life.
Correct. Yeah, I've been retired since December 2008 from the military. It's discouraging. It's discouraging on many, many levels. I mentioned leaving Iraq. They're disturbing things in the papers every day about how talks with Afghanistan are not going as planned, et cetera.
Yeah.
If we completely pull out of Afghanistan like we did Iraq, it's worse than even starting over, because the people who are taking over in those places know that we are weak and will exploit that and have exploited it and will continue to exploit it, and they will think of new ways. When I was in Iraq at a very remote forward operating base, we had kind of gotten into a battle rhythm where we kind of knew what the enemy was going to do and could counter the things that the enemy did. But just before I got pulled out, they went back to a very old way of doing things. They went to a pressure release type of bomb instead of the IEDs we were so used to. And several soldiers were killed. And it was just so discouraging that that had happened. But we are fighting an insidious enemy. We are fighting an enemy that doesn't care about death. And that is the most dangerous enemy. So we have to get inside their head and perpetrate total war on them. We need to seek them out wherever they are and bring them in and then question them. You know, Obama said he wanted to close Gitmo. And in the same hand, Kelly, he's decided to perpetrate a drone war where he's killing off all the intelligence
that
we could gain. So it's almost as if he's giving aid and comfort to the enemy, which is the constitutional definition of treason.
And you know what? This is going to have to be a part two between you and myself. This has just been fascinating, but I have been keeping you. I am nearly out of your time, but one thing I want to finalize, and this is just to I'm going to get a little personal with you. First of all, you snore. I did not know that.
I snored then. I don't snore.
You had your own condo unit. Nobody else would share a bunk with you. I found
that. Yeah, it was pretty funny.
Oh, like, this is what I loved about the book, is that you interspersed so many great moments of for us to relate to. It's a fantastic book in that sense, but there's something else that you relate throughout the book, and that is the love for your family and how you would struggle with being away, especially with your one son in particular. But at the time, you were the father of three boys and married to a lovely, lovely lady. And you're now the father of five children. But back then, your youngest boy, I mean, he had just been born, and there you were leaving. And you had to deal with that. And that was a personal struggle for you virtually every day, in that emails and telephone calls just weren't enough. And you had very, very torturous moments in missing your family and the guilt that you felt not being there for your family, and how you dealt with that. And it's how you write it in the book. I was brought to tears. Like, I had to put down my book, and I had to get a Kleenex, because just the way you write, it's so eloquent, and that you really do encompass the every soldier, in that I'm a soldier and I have to defend my country, but damn it, I miss my family. I do not want to be doing this. Mm-hmm. I know that you feel, you wish that soldiering would be put out of work so that people, men and women, do not have to leave their families to engage in this latest scourge, and that is the war, the terrorist war on us. It's a beautifully written book, Monty. And it's just
thank you
wonderful.
So much. I really appreciate your kindness.
Oh, I will let you go because you're having family night. But before I do, I want to share with my listeners, Monty wrote in his book that I'm not going to tell the listeners how you, when you finally came home and saw your family again, they're going to have to read the book. But it's probably one of the most touching moments that I had read in a long time. However, you did touch on something that you were listening. You were coming home from an event, and you were listening to a song on the radio, and that was a song by Celine Dion, and that was God Bless America, and how that touched you so very deeply. So, Monty,
so
I'm going
to
let you go. I'm going
to
be in touch with you via email a little later on, because we do have so much more to talk about. I really want to thank you, though. I want to let you get back to your family, your beautiful wife and your five kids, but I want to leave you with this. Ladies and gentlemen, just to remind you, that was Montgomery J. Granger, Major, retired, my guest tonight. And I'm sharing this with you. Please, I'll be back in a few moments.
Ladies and gentlemen, Celine Dion in the cast of A National Salute to the U.S. Military.
aft on board the USS Harry S. Truman. Good luck and Godspeed to America's Armed Services. You are the best!
And welcome back, everybody, to the Red Fox Blogger. And just to remind you, you're listening to your humble host, Kel Fritzy. I am very overwhelmed and very happy that I was able to interview Montgomery J. Granger. Please buy the book. It is it's the best read you're going to have because it's not only such an insight as to what life in the military is about, but in particular dealing with the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, and simply being deployed in general. This book is interspersed with so many themes that it will leave you overwhelmed. It will leave you laughing at times, but it will leave you commiserative tears. A wonderful book. I read it in like 2 days. If you put all the hours I put in there together doing it. So I want to really thank Monty for joining me, and I'm very honored that I could refer to him as Monty. And I think I still have him right here on the line with me. Monty?
Yes. I'm wiping my eyes from the Celine Dion performance. That was sneaky of me, but I appreciate it.
I thought that was something that... Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm very proud as a Canadian that I could give her, I could offer her up to the world because she's one of my favorite singers. As a matter of fact, she sings that O Holy Night like nobody's business.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's, if I could only emulate her singing voice, but I can't. So I won't even try.
I'm so grateful to you, Kelly. I'm grateful that you invited me on, and you're so gracious, and I really appreciate your support and your patriotism.
Thank you, Monty. I'm going to let you go now and spend time with your beautiful family. I hope
my
that
hero,
I can have
my
you.
My personal hero, my wife.
Oh, she is wonderful. Would you like to come back on the show sometime in the future? Because,
sure.
Like I'm telling you, I was going to do the 40 question thing, but I would have kept you for 3 hours if I did that.
That's very nice.
We can find we'll find all sorts of things to talk about. I am very much. I love our troops. I love our men and women in the military. We have troops internationally. We have troops deployed internationally. We have to support our men and women. I may be in Canada, but I always say this to my listeners, Monty. I say that mm-hmm. I live in the best country in the world, but the United States is the greatest nation on the planet. And people understand exactly where I'm coming from. This is why I do this program, too. I'm so glad that my program is based out of the United States. It is my utmost pleasure to have people like yourself on my humble little program and to spend your valuable time with me, like I mentioned at the very beginning of the program, because I know how busy people are out there. Monty, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Kelly. God bless. And
God
bless. And to all your listeners, good night.
Good night. Thank you. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a little bit of another break and come back and wrap up the last 20 minutes of the after. Well, I've got 30 minutes. Yay, I've got 30 minutes of talking time. But I want to play a song here for a friend of mine. I want to come back. I have a topic for you. Oh, the Red Fox always does. I'm going to play a song, though, and this goes out to a very, very dear friend of mine who is a little under the weather, but he's a trooper. He's one of my very best friends, and this is for him. I will see you guys back here in a moment. Frankly, I don't have a whole lot prepared, but I did want to share something with you, which I thought you might find of interest, is that I'm not sure if you're aware, but the other day Canada underwent a bomb threat, and this involved our parliament buildings in Ottawa. Now, apparently there was a Muslim who approached the parliament, the prime minister's office, and he said to security, "I have a bomb in my briefcase." Well, you know what happened, right? Yeah. Evacuation, the bomb robots come out, and this guy, well, it turned out to be, it was a hoax, but this Muslim, he decided that, well, he was mad about something, and, well, quite frankly, when are they not, right? He was mad that he might be kicked out of his social housing or council housing because the authorities were wondering if all of his seven children were residents of Canada or if they were actually residing in Somalia. Now, his name is Mohammed Hersi Jamil. He's 45 years old, so he did not like that. He didn't like the fact that he was going to lose his welfare benefits, so off to Ottawa from Toronto he went, and he decided that he was going to make a statement. Of course, he had no bomb. It was a false threat. Well, it was a real threat, but you know what I mean. There was no bomb. So I got a bit of an update for that, and I love this, alleged scare. Yeah, because it's alleged, we always have to use that term because he has not been convicted. Oh, you gotta love that. However, the wife of our good old friend Mohammed here, her name is Faz Elmi. She's 44 years old. And she said that her husband has been mentally ill for the better part of two decades, for the better part, rather, of two decades. So she told the Toronto Sun yesterday, that she doesn't know why her husband allegedly ventured into the government building housing of the Prime Minister's office on Wednesday with a briefcase he said contained a bomb and began threatening people. Now, Elmi called her husband of 18 years a gentle man dedicated to his Muslim faith. I don't know why he went to Ottawa, she said, outside the Weston Road apartment she shares with Jamal and their seven children. Through an acquaintance who acted as an interpreter, Elmi said it was a surprise to us that this man had been in Ottawa doing these things. He has many struggles, and they've been left him unable to work, said his wife of seven children who is collecting welfare and who is a stay-at-home mom. She wouldn't say how they support the family. Us! But I don't know. Welfare creeps with seven kids. Jamal and Elmi, they came to Canada from, Somalia. Now, their acquaintance doing, I suppose he's the one or she's the one doing the interpreting. Oh, no, it's a he. Yeah. He's a local business owner, and he would only identify himself as Abi. And he said Jamal regularly attends the mosque at the nearby Bokhari Islamic Center on Weston Road in the Lawrence Avenue area. The mosque's acting imam, Jama Shire, he said he didn't recognize Jamil's name. Isn't that familiar? It's funny. When these perpetrators are arrested and they're affiliated with a certain mosque, it's amazing how the imams don't find them on their blog roll. I'll get to that in a minute. I have a point about that. Anyway, the acquaintance, the local business owner, Abdi, was quick to stress that Jamal was a gentle Muslim who isn't radical in his religious views and that the only thing that seemed to anger him lately wasn't being able to access English language training. But this guy, he's no stranger to the law up here in Canada. Oh, no, he's not. He was convicted in 1998 in Toronto for communication for the purpose of prostitution. He was fined $250 and was ordered to pay a $37.50 victim surcharge fee, whatever that means. He faced several other charges over the 3 years, but they were withdrawn. Jamal is now charged with one count of uttering threats and one of mischief after Wednesday's incident in Ottawa. He has also been ordered to see a psychiatrist. Yeah, the whole place was evacuated. Prime Minister Stephen Harper, he was not in the building at the time. No, he's over overseas negotiating a free trade agreement between Canada and the European Union. So, yeah, he's not around. He's busy creating 100,000 jobs. Thank you very much. All these roads, they were shut down for several hours. Police had to investigate. They had to bring out the bomb squad. Ladies and gentlemen, I implore you, what kind of people are we importing into our respective Western countries? This guy had been hanging around here collecting welfare with his baghead wife, good old Foz. They had 7 kids. They were on the dole. He was questioned about the legitimacy of his collection, and he got mad about that. So he went to Ottawa, and he was going to shut down the parliament. Mm-hmm. This really floored me, though. He had been experiencing mental illness for the better part of 20 years. How did they get to Canada? And believe me, if he had been suffering mental illness for the better part of 20 years, and he still had to take English courses, you can bet he hadn't been here for 20 years. So how on earth did this creature pass the sniff test to get into Canada in the first place is beyond me. This is happening not only in Canada, it is happening in the United States, in the United Kingdom, all over Australia. It is just absolutely sickening in that these people seem to get in here. They seem to get here. They seem to sneak under the radar, and they pollute the host country of which they have come. I ask you again, what are we going to do about it, and how do we stop it? Personally, I say enough is absolutely enough. I've had it up to here. I opened up my dailies on Wednesday morning, and I saw, Prime Minister's offices evacuated due to bomb scare. Well, it didn't take us too long to figure out exactly who was behind that. I was reading the article in the Toronto Sun. The comment section was priceless. There were over 200 comments, and the Toronto Sun, in their ultimate wisdom, they had shut down the comment section, and not only that, not even comments are now closed for this article. They have removed all the comments. Now, I don't know what that means, whether or not they're actually going to file them and forward them. I don't know. I'll tell you one thing, though, is that when you visit a comment section in a newspaper and that comment section is still accepting your say, you can bet that there are people monitoring it, whether it be a political aide or whatever. The comments do get read. The comments are registered. If you have something to say, say it in the comment section. Use a pseudonym and open up if you're worried about things coming back at you in terms of your IPU, I don't know what that's called, something like that. Your home computer, when it comes back to you, don't worry about it. Open up another IPU, whatever. But get busy and get out there and get talking and get discussing and get sharing and get angry about this nonsense going on in our countries. I, for one, have had enough of it. This guy was sitting around here for less than 20 years, but he had mental health issues for around 20, according to his bag wife. No, no, no. Don't want that in the country at all. Not at all. I am going to leave, but I do have somebody here. If you want to talk to me, just press 1 on your phone and so that I know that you want to come on the air. Otherwise, I will allow you to listen. I've had it, though. I'm so tired of hearing these stories. Sing it again. So please try to listen. But I do have Matt here, and he does want to come on the air. So I'm going to take Matt's call right now and welcome him to the program. And hi, Matt. How are you tonight?
I am wonderful. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to hear you again.
I got to tell you, I can hear the more and more I listen to shows like this, and more I listen to people like you, the more frustration I hear. And there's a reason for that, and that's because of the state of our country and what things are going through. It's not just – like, you're Canadian, yeah. Correct? Is that what I heard? I'm a new listener.
I am, but I consider myself a North American at this point.
I think we all can. I have very good friends that are Canadian. We talk about the same issues. I think it's the same problems that present either our continent – or us as humanity, really. If you look at what's going on with liberalism or with progressivism and all these things that are happening, it's the same exact problems. And when I saw this thing today, and this is one of the reasons that I called up, and I'm trying to spread this as much as I can. If you've ever heard of Ed Schultz, he is a commentator for MSNBC. He
mm-hmm.
took a call. A war veteran who called up. I'm sorry that he had the nerve to question what was going on with his health care, but it dealt with government health care and what he got as a veteran. And he was just trying to state a point, and he could barely get the point out. And Ed Schultz of MSNBC and the liberal that he is and what he represents as a liberal and what you usually run into as a liberal, this man decided to lay down every bit of hell on this veteran, this man who fought for freedom, whether it be for America or the North Americans as Canadians, like the Canadians did for World War II, along with the
mm-hmm.
United States and everybody else. This man, Ed Schultz, decided to lay down the gauntlet and shut this war hero, this man who laid down his life for freedom, down. It was the most disgusting bit of I don't even know how to describe it. I'm so disgusted I can't even put it into words. I got to tell you guys, if you know liberals, if you talk to liberals, you need to start bringing these things up as hard as you can and say, where are you going with your thought? You need to start making sense when you're talking about your point of view. You can't just keep repeating these lines that are coming up from your political standpoint. You need to start making sense. Because Ed Schultz, I'm sorry, I'm not a war veteran. I've never been in the
mm-hmm.
military. My father was, he was 82nd and 101st Airborne with the Army. I have many friends that are Marines. Three of them, just in the past year and a half, have come back here without at least one limb. And, oh, by the way, in the last 3 years, Barack Obama promised that we would not be in war right now, but yet these gentlemen in the past 3 years have lost their digits. Can somebody please explain that to me? I'm pissed. That's all I got to say.
I don't understand how MSNBC is still going. He's got all those crazies over there. You got Ed Schultz, you've got Rachel Maddow, or as I call her, Rachel Madcow. I think everybody calls her that. You've got all these crazies on the air, on the airwaves over there, and they're espousing this nonsense. And what you're relating, Matt, the latest from Ed Schultz is just, it's mind-boggling. However, people still eat this up. But was Ed Schultz actually demoted? Even NBC, did they demote him or something?
I believe
because
he was. I believe
be
he
coming.
I believe he was demoted to a talk show, to a radio talk show.
Okay.
Which, right. So, I don't think he has the TV airwaves anymore. But it doesn't matter. Ed Schultz, it's like, I forgot the guy's name, not Matthews, the guy who got kicked off of MSNBC. I can't remember his name right now. But it doesn't matter who you demote.
Yeah.
They still carry the voice. They carry more of a voice than I do. They carry more of a voice than you do. No offense. And that's what's scary.
I think I know who you're talking about, who was fired from MSNBC. I think he had I can see him in my mind.
Yeah, he had the glasses and he pretended to be
him.
Mr. Brainiac.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, yeah, and he had a voice. He had a very good voice for TV and radio. And he would say things like
Keith Olbermann.
That's the guy.
Is
yeah.
that the one? Okay,
yeah.
I knew it would come to me because I remember that. Yeah, he had that very clipped voice of his, and he looked very intelligent with the glasses and the clipped voice. Yeah, that's the one.
Yes, and he was very demeaning in his tone, and you have to be demeaning in your tone, I guess, if you're a liberal, because you really have nothing to back your argument on unless you have a really good voice, and you can be demeaning, and you can, I guess, try to overpower somebody with the way that you talk.
Oh, well, who's that? Who is that person on? What's his name? CNN, Piers Morgan.
Yeah.
Matt, what is going on down there?
Listen, when you got an Englishman,
I bang my desk some days.
When you got an Englishman that can carry the hearts and minds of a certain a pretty major a faction of Americans, you know you got a problem in America.
Well, I just looked down, and I swear, these people get jobs because they have pseudo credentials within the media, and they have these lovely voices. And when you have an Englishman on American television, it's because, oh, he sounds so intelligent. And I've heard that before, and it's like, well, as a person of English descent, I actually find that rather insulting. But this is what people like. They like the accented, $20 words that they can throw around.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You throw around a $20 word, and you sound like you know what you're talking about. People eat that up. And hey, Matt, you know what I call them as well? The underinformed voter.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you know what? That's the scariest thing of all. I could blame this all on Ed Schultz. I could blame this all on Keith Olbermann. Mm. I could blame this all on Chris Matthews. I could blame these all on whatever. But you know what? I would be wrong. And I would be completely, completely in the wrong of blaming those people, because really, when it comes down to rubber meets the road, who is to blame for the problems that we have right now? It's the American voter and what they're willing to accept. I understand that there are people out there that are pretty, they're able to easily persuade people in one way or the other. But if America is so easily persuaded by, say, the Desperate Housewives or Kim Kardashian or all of these other ridiculous, hey, look over there while the birdie's over here, right? If they're able to be persuaded that way, then the real issue lies not really on our media. It lies on the voter. It lies on the people that vote what we have in today. That's what's happened. The reason why we have what we have is because we voted it in. And it's scary.
It's a sleight of hand. It's like, let's all play a game of a snookered and see who we can snooker today. That's exactly what it is. I get so amused, distraught, and sometimes rather depressed when I see what comes out of the MSM. And this is why I'm always telling people that you cannot go to the MSM. But how do we convince the bleating masses? It's impossible to do. They won't listen. They're going to go there, and I swear I have days like this.
What was that?
Where I just, that was me screaming.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm a soundbite fanatic.
It's very
discouraging when this is the best and the brightest that we can bring on. And believe me, it is not confined to the United States. It's happening in Canada as well. It's happening in Britain as well. I mean, you listen to East Anglian EDL radio show, oh boy, they have all sorts of things that they can share with you about the idiocy of the media that they unfortunately have to endure.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. I have a lot of Australian friends, and they told me the same thing. They said, you know what? We're going the same way. They actually tell me they're way ahead of us, which they are. And you know, they're like America and really Canada and America has had quite a wonderful relationship for the past few years. And the funny thing is especially if you start talking about socialized healthcare, America is going to surpass Canada with any type of a healthcare program that Canada ever offered. I would have to say that Canada is progressing while America is regressing. And it's kind of a strange thing to see. Would you agree with that or no?
Well, Canada, it has quite the few warts. And see, I don't know if the United States is trying to follow a Canadian model system. If it is, don't do it. Don't. Do not do it. After education, healthcare is our highest taxed item. Now, Canada being a population of 34 going on 35 million, it's barely sustainable. What's the population of the United States? Over 300 million, right?
Yeah, it's pushing 340 right now.
There is no way. There is absolutely no way that the United States could sustain a Canadian-style healthcare system. And plus, too, Obamacare, he also wants to be inclusive of illegal aliens and refugees.
Right, there's the inclusive of that. Well, what you're talking about is absolutely correct. And yet, they're willing to exempt a ton of corporations, which is weird. You know, you're going to exempt a bunch of corporations.
That's so strange.
Yeah, well,
that's the most bizarre thing.
That's what you call fascism. That's where fascism comes in. It's the marriage of corporations with government. That's the definition of fascism, and that's what they're doing. So when you say, well, we're going to ensure these illegal aliens, but yet we're going to disclude and exempt these corporations along with all these government officials, you're basically kind of offsetting that number. It's really strange. It really is.
All I can say is that the United States, with Barack Hussein Obama, you have got to be so careful with that, man. People probably don't believe, you know, well, it's not that they don't believe, it's just that they're unaware that Obama, he is the equivalent. He's a socialist, and he's the equivalent of a Hitler. He really is. And they share, pardon me, and they share very popular traits.
Yes.
Very much so.
And it doesn't mean towards the end. Obama hasn't put anybody in ovens. Because a lot of people tell me, well, that's just awful rhetoric that you're saying, comparing Obama to Hitler. And I'll say, wait a second. When Hitler was running for power in Germany, when he was pushing for that power, he used a lot of the same rhetoric. He won over the Jews. He won them over. There wasn't one Jew while Hitler was running that didn't think that Adolf Hitler was in their corner. And that's exactly what Barack Obama's doing with the same rhetoric. As a matter of fact, Barack Obama is worse because if you read his books, he actually wrote books telling you what he was going to do. There's two of them in particular.
Yeah,
Matt,
I have something right here for you. And I know a lot of people, like they do say, oh, you know, people balk at the comparisons between Hitler and Obama. They say it's unfair. But you have to understand the comparisons are rather, they're rather fair when you think that Hitler ran on a platform that Hitler's platform killed 11 million people, Jews, Gentiles, Gypsies, the disabled. Obama, he didn't do anything like that. But it's a comparison against Hitler and Obama at the end of Hitler's rule. Now, when you think about this, it is a fair comparison. And if people think that I'm a racist for doing this, I'm sorry, but there are facts out there that back this up. Both Hitler and Obama, they held rallies in outdoor stadiums. They excited and they inflame people. Hitler excited, Obama excites, and he inflames. He inflames the people's passions. Women fell in love with these two. Both Hitler and Obama, they wrote ghostwritten autobiographies prior to the start of their run for political office. Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, right? Obama wrote Dreams of My Father. Both men, they wrote a second book talking about their goals. Hitler and Obama, they had original last names that they changed later in life. Hitler used to be Schuckelbruger. Obama's last name was Soretto. Hitler and Obama hid their real identities. Hitler had a Jewish ancestry, and Obama a Muslim one. Unlike Hitler, though, Obama flaunted his Muslim roots in the start at his political career because that would defuse the inevitable firestorm, because we all know how we feel about Muslims. Hitler and Obama supporters followed them blindly and without question. Hitler and Obama used political power and coercion to conceal and hide their birth certificates. Hitler and Obama advocate using young people as the driving force to create an army of youth dedicated to their ideas. Hitler had his Hitler Youth. Obama has Obama Youth Brigade. Both Hitler and Obama were known for their tremendous oratorical skills. Hitler and Obama received messianic comparisons. Hitler, Obama, they rule in direct disregard to the will and wishes of the people. Hitler and Obama, they have an obvious distaste for Jews. Hitler and Obama were able to mesmerize the people, even though it was obvious that they were both saying what they were saying was not true. Hitler and Obama used domestic terrorists to launch their careers. Hitler had his brown shirts from the beer hall days, and Obama has people like Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dom, and Rashid Khalidi. Both Hitler and Obama advocate using murder as a means of population control. So if that is not a fair comparison, Matt, I don't know what is.
Oh, well, now, wait a second. You have to be prepared for that argument, that very last one that you just said. Hitler and Obama use murder as a means of population control.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Well, people would say, well, you know what? Hitler put Jews in ovens. What did Obama do? Well, okay, you tell me what Obama did. If you can't answer that, I'll do it gladly for you. How is Obama using murder to get his way?
Planned Parenthood.
Ta-da! There it is. And what does Planned Parenthood mean?
Abortion rights. Abortion on demand.
Who pays for abortion now through Obamacare?
You, the taxpayer.
Ta-da. Whether you agree with it or not, congratulations, Americans. You are now responsible for ripping the heads off of little innocent children with forceps and then sucking the rest of the body out like a Hoover vacuum cleaner. Good job for voting that one in.
Yeah, isn't that lovely? I could go on all night about this. I have clips. I have drop down menus left, right, and center. I have YouTube videos I could play. I have all sorts of things here, Matt, because I'm an outsider looking in, right? I am not, like, a lot of people are becoming more and more aware of what Obama is up to. And I have a lot of Canadian listeners very hungry for news from the United States, and they're not getting it through the mainstream media. Blog Talk Radio is still very new to them. I try to make as much sense and be as comprehensive as possible in relating that there's something going on in the United States, and we have to stick with our cousins down there because Obama is making a true mess of things. Obama is totally messing up free trade with us, and we're not happy.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, Prime Minister Stephen Harper, he just came back. Well, he's still over there, actually, because he's still letting the ink dry. But we are now engaging in a free trade agreement with the European Union. And that is because we are trying to get off the dependency of the United States. And it's not the United States people, it's Obama's America. We are also engaging full force in our Keystone pipelines and our other. We have enough oil to sustain generations. Obama wants no part of that. So Harper said, fine, forget it. I'll just send it to China, and I'll set up a free trade with them. Like, Canada's getting very sick and tired.
You know what? As an American, I can understand it, and all the grace of God with them. I don't know what else you would do. I mean, this is when you talk about, as we said, Canada and America are very close cousins. We live on the same landmass. We share the same reserves for the most part. Why the hell should America dictate what Canada can do with their own reserves or who they can, you know, who they can make deals with? I say I give all the glory to Canada right now. Go split, run like hell, go do your own thing, make it happen. Because it right now, the way America is, the way Obama is controlling through certain federal guidelines, you're not going to be able to get out of it. Run.
See, Stephen Harper tried to work with Obama, and Obama wanted no part of it. And Canada, we set up committees. We spent a lot of money. So did the United States. The United States and Canada, the people, we all were working together because the United States people, they really wanted the Keystone Pipeline. They really, really wanted it because they found a solution to get off Saudi oil. They thought Canada is going to help us out, and when we have the Keystone, then we can open up our drilling in the Gulf Shores. We can open up fracking. We can start to become self-sufficient. We can get away from Saudi Arabia probably within a decade, a little more maybe, who knows. But Obama turned around and essentially told Canada to shove it. We don't want any part of it. So whether or not the Keystone is going to be in a demise in the United States, which would be very unfortunate, and Bigfoot, thank you, Venezuela as well. Good point, Bigfoot. Yep, Bigfoot's right. Get the United States off Saudi Arabia and get them off of Venezuelan oil as well. And Barack Hussein Obama is messing that up. And Stephen Harper is saying, fine, I'll send up the gateway and I'll send the oil to China and I'll turn them into a trading partner.
You know what, if I could add to that too, I live in the Ohio area. I live in the Akron area. And to the southeast of where I live, we have a lot of coal country. Pennsylvania, Ohio, and a lot of these two states went for Obama this past election, which is beyond me. But what has happened since Obama took office for the second time is that we have had, and this is not a joke, you can all research this, we have had between a 60 and 75% of all coal plants shut down. So all of those workers are out of jobs. Coal is no longer a major Ohio and Pennsylvania or Eastern Ohio and Western Pennsylvania commodity, which is a huge killer to jobs in those areas. I can't even explain to you how big of a killer of jobs it is.
I can imagine, Matt. Oh,
it's ridiculous.
Imagine. Now, how long has coal been around? Like, we've had coal plants for how many? Now that we're in 2013, I'm almost going to say, you know, decades and decades and decades. Coal plants have been around for a very long time, but all of a sudden all these global alarmists came along and they're shutting down the coal fire plants and they're shutting down. The trickle-down effect is unbelievable from what I can see.
Wait a second. What do you mean alarmist? You mean the people that that come up like Al Gore, the people that say, "Hey,
coal-fired plants are contributing to global warming."
They're contributing to global warming. You're killing the planet. But if you pay us, will overlook it in the form of carbon credits. Is that the people you're talking about, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, okay, keep your plant open, but we're going to tax the hell out of you with the carbon credits.
Right, that's how we care about the environment. As long as you're filling our pockets, we'll let you stay in business because we care about the environment. What
you've got it.
Does that make the people on the left? I'm curious.
I had a fellow up here in Canada. His name was Jack Layton. He's since passed away, God rest his soul. He was quite the socialist. He was a very influential politician. He was actually the leader of the official opposition, New Democratic Party. At the time, very charismatic, very, very nice guy, very caring, man of the people sort of. However, he wanted to introduce carbon credits, and as soon as those noises were being made, Matt, we had businesses shutting down and going to Mexico.
Okay, once again, they may shut You may shut them down in the country of origin, but what you just said is they'll find another place to go. So, again, I have to ask, what good is the carbon credit tax?
Yeah. You nailed it.
Here in America, we have a fine that's going up on workers. I don't know how much your listening audience knows or you know about this. But if you're a cattle farmer, and you have, and now it's law, if you have beyond a certain amount of steer or cows per acreage, you have to pay a fine on those certain amount past the amount you're allowed to have because, and I'm going to try to put this nicely because I'm not sure how your show runs, because those cows or bulls flatulate. This is no joke. Because cows fart, you have to pay more to the U.S. government in lieu of global warming.
Yeah. They fart, so they're putting more ethanol in the atmosphere. And so that's good too. I love that.
Apparently the dinosaurs that died out 5 billion years ago never farted. I'm just letting you know.
Yeah, flatulence is something totally brand new. Ethanol, yeah. Well, it was funny. I was talking with a friend of mine about that, and we were actually sitting around, and like physically, we were sitting around, and we were talking about that, and we were brainstorming on trying to figure out how we could bottle cow farts and sell it.
You would solve the
insanity. Like, that's how stupid this whole thing is.
You would solve the energy crisis. You really would.
Oh, yeah. We'd be off the Saudi and Venezuelan oil boom like that. Oh, what can I tell you, though? It's a mad, mad world out there right now. I do feel, I feel Americans' pain. I'm so sorry that you have to endure this guy for another 3 years. I don't know. I'm closing out the show in a minute, but before I do, Matt, I have a question for you. There are a lot of people talking about if Obama's first term was all about rhetoric and promises, but if he's reelected, what could he do to that country during his second term? Because he's not coming back, and he doesn't care. I have not seen so much damage done to a country in my life with the Obamacare, with the Islamic appeasement, with his drones, with his interfering with foreign policy. He's the worst foreign policy maker I've ever seen in my life. He's lousy at it. He makes us go out and buy our Jimmy Carter Do You Miss Me Yet t-shirts, this one. But do you think you've got 3 more years of him. What do you think he's capable of? How much more damage can he do to the country?
You know what? I'm going to be very honest. When Obama was elected for the second time, I also have a Blog Talk Radio show, and I'm not going to try to plug it. I'm just letting you know that I said something.
Matt, plug
on...
it. Plug your show, please. Matt, please plug your show.
I feel bad about doing that because
I encourage everybody to listen to all the programs on Blog Talk Radio. I'm trying to get them off the mainstream media. I'm trying to get them all over here to Blog Talk Radio. The more shows they can listen to, the better. And you're obviously a conservative, so please, I want you to tell people where they can find you.
I'll tell you what, just because I don't run a Friday show, so I'm not competing, so I will, I'll go through with it. It's called The Search for Verity, V-E-R-I-T-Y, The Search for Verity radio program.
Awesome.
And I've been in hiatus for a little while. I'm going to be getting back into it here shortly. But when Obama was reelected, I made this point, and I said, you know what? Since the American people are so willing to put aside every ideal of the founding of this country, and they are so willing to accept any rhetoric that comes their way, regardless of what history has showed them, if they've even studied it, then America needs to suffer. And America right now needs to suffer. All of these liberal programs need to go through. Obamacare needs to go through. Conservatives, and I'm not calling Republicans in America conservatives because they've been, you know, scooting to the left for quite some time. But conservatives need to step out of the way so that liberalism can be driven through like a nail so fast and so harsh that people can see it literally materialize before their eyes in 5 to 10 years and suffer from it. And there will only be one faction holding the cards that you can point at and say, it's your fault. That is the, in my opinion, that is the only escape route for this country, because the way I look at it, not just liberalism, but progressivism has been so woven into the fabric of this country that I feel unless we have a complete and total collapse, kind of like a crack addict or an alcoholic, unless we have a complete and total collapse, things will never change. And people need to see who is responsible, and it needs to happen now.
Any chance of you coming back on the air?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I like this show. I was listening when I first tuned in. I listened for about a half an hour. I liked what I heard. So, yeah, I'll definitely be back in.
I just found your show, and I put it in the chat room.
Oh, yeah, there it is right there. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Oh, and you also, you have a Facebook page.
Yes, I have a Facebook page that I lied on and said that I would be back in October, and that hasn't happened yet. So I think I'm a big liar, but I'm trying to get a huge system together. I had a few guests that canceled on me because they had some well, let me put it this way. There are people running for Senate and Congress, and when they say, yeah, I'll be there, kind of, you know what I mean? You take that as it is. So probably in November I'll be back.
Oh, well, come. Oh, I'm looking forward to it. You see, this is what I love doing. This is part of the charm of Blog Talk Radio. I try to explain this to people is that this is citizen journalism. We're not polished bubble-headed bleach blondes. Oh, that's a hard word to say. That's a hard phrase to say.
A good attempt.
We're not sitting behind a desk and reading a teleprompter. We are citizen journalists, and we give you the straight goods that you're not going to find on the MSN. This is why I'm so fed up with MSN. And I tell everybody, you have to get to Blog Talk Radio. There's a lot of fine internet radio programs out there. There's a few I really love. Mark Levin is one of my favorites. I love listening to him. He's a rare breed. There are radio programs. You got the Ken Pettigrew show out there. You've got Jimmy C. Zoltz out there. You've got, now we're going to get Matt for America back out there. You've got me out there. You've got all the folks from Reactionary Speaks out there. You've got people from Radio Jihad Network, East Anglia, and EDO Radio Show. We have all the conservative shows. You've got, hey, we built that network. You've got Politically Incorrect. If you don't like it, don't listen. All these beautiful programs, and you can hear a lot of them right here on Blog Talk Radio, and I am so pleased to hear that Matt for America is going to be back soon with us. Now, I'm down to 13 minutes, but I have somebody here, Matt. I think he wants to say a word. Do you want to stay with me and take a listen?
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead, Kelly.
You bet. Hi, 817.
Hey, guys. This is Smith Fix all over the Internet. I just wanted to open the view just a little bit. Whenever we blame Obama, we need to look at our past presidents, starting at Reagan,
okay,
who I loved during, back in the day. He started COG, you know, with that traitor, you know, colonel of his. And it's absolutely traitor.
I have to
now.
Give you that. Yes, I have to give
okay.
you that.
So this is building, and I posted in the chat room a video I made some time ago called Veteran and Patriot for Obama. And they did exactly
okay.
what I said they would do. They gave us a worthless rhino who was every bit the fascist that, you know, that Obama is the communist. And this is a choice. So let's understand, we don't have any allies. And I totally agree with what you were saying about Blog Talk Radio and the alternative media, and we all need to work together and cross-multiply.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely agree.
Well,
let's
you,
get out of this paradigm.
Thank you for that.
Let's get out of this paradigm, because we don't have any allies.
If I could answer, and he's absolutely right, there's a lot of people that are like, well, nobody's in office for us, and that is absolutely true. But we need to make sure that we have definition on task. Definition of what Obama is doing right now is fascism. Communism is down the line. And that's in his plans, I believe, absolutely. He's not a communist yet. We have centralized government, absolute centralized government with slavery of the people is down the line. It isn't here yet. But the marriage between corporation and government is here, and it's what Obama wants. So we need to make sure that even though nobody's in our corner in Washington, that we have our definitions of what socialism, fascism, and communism are. And I have to agree with the guy, except I would like him to re-clarify, because I'm not sure I understand what he was talking about with Reagan. Is he still on the line? Can you clarify?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Pardon me.
Well,
yes,
I'm here.
Go ahead, Torch.
I loved Ronnie Reagan until I've had a chance to, in hindsight, I mean, I'm 55 years old. And in hindsight, looking at what he started to create, Ollie North was hauling drugs and guns and all the stuff that we have today that our CIA is doing. They put it in place. So there's a foundation, and it just grew from there. And I loved Ronnie Reagan. I didn't understand then. I'm one of the progenitors of the Tea Party, one of the progenitors of Glenn Beck's 912 until I woke up about a year later and realized, my God, I'm being betrayed on all sides here.
Okay.
So,
all right. Now I see where you're coming from, sir. And I understand it, and I agree with it. However, a lot of people, let's just look at this latest, not the latest, but a couple years after Obama was elected, there was an uprising in Iran. And there was a lot of Tea Party members, which I'm not against the Tea Party. I'm actually very for the Tea Party. There was a lot of Tea Party members and semi-conservative members that were upset that we weren't backing the revolution of the people trying to rise up against Iran by providing them weapons and such. So it was kind of history repeating itself. What did you think about that when you think about what was going on with Reagan?
I put that with what's going on in Syria, where we take Al-Qaeda and we arm Al-Qaeda because we want a tyrant in there that is going to obey America to try and keep
now
the petrodollar.
Now you're talking my game.
And all the power of America, the petrodollar. I mean, look, we are the most evil nation in the world. We're hated universally across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I want you guys to, I know you're short of time, and you close your show out. I'm revamping all of my platforms right now, and I'm the leader of PANDA, People Against the NDAA, in Texas, and all kinds of stuff I'm doing right now. I'll be back on Blog Talk big time pretty soon. I've got a Sunday show that I'm going to be putting on for
Torch
PANDA.
And Matt, both of you, please get in touch with me. There are so many ways you can get in touch with me. I have my Twitter. If you're on Twitter, you can get in touch with me at Twitter at .com/ruffianc. The link is right there in my show notes. You can get in touch with me on Red Fox Blogger at blogspot.com. Or you can get in touch with me on Facebook, and that's Cal Fritzy. So there's all sorts of ways to get in touch with me. So I would love for both of you gentlemen to please let's connect, and I would love to pick this up.
Oh, I would love to, because I really believe we must cross-multiply right now. We must communicate with each other and grow the movement and get out of our conch shell. Quit talking to just each other and get these ideas out there in the street. I've got a protest again in Fort Worth for a no-war protest every Saturday evening down where the people gather to go to dinner. And we get down there among them and spread out all over, handing them information, talking to them. I mean, we don't have a lot of time, right?
That's right.
And, I tell you what, I need to let you close your show out. I'll get in touch with you, sweetie, and your guest.
You.
I caught in late. I wish I'd have caught in a little bit earlier, and I understand, you know, you're revamping your platforms as well, my friend.
I'm always going to be talking about the issues of Islam.
I like mixing
it up. It's always great to mix it up.
One last thing. If everybody will just punch in a Google search called We Are Not Your Enemy on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Find something I did there that I think they'll like. It's called We Are Not Your Enemy by Smith Fix. And that's something I really want to push, because we, the American people, are not the enemy of the world. Our government is.
Okay.
We will
gentlemen,
see you. Are you on every week, darling? I've got to figure out how to follow your show.
I am on Mondays at 3 p.m. and Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time.
And what, Mondays and then when?
Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time and Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time.
It'll be Fridays I can catch you. Usually I'm working on audio files and everything the rest of the time.
Okay, do so. And like
darling.
I say, do get in touch with me via all those avenues. I'm all over the place. And I'm around, and I'm always looking for new voices and new ideas, believe me.
Well, we're all on the same sheet of music. Sometimes we have to just work out our terminology that they've destroyed so much, you know. Great show, darling. And God bless. Y'all have a good evening, okay?
God bless. And Matt, I'll be in touch with you via Facebook as well, if that's okay.
That is absolutely
all
right. And I want to say to the gentleman, the last gentleman caller, that I'm in complete agreement with what he's saying, and I would be more interested in hearing about what he has to do. So I would like to know more information about where he's going, so that works out.
Sounds great. And
just punch in Smith Fix on the internet. Just punch in Smith Fix, and you can find me so easily. It's SMITHFIX, and
okay,
I'm all over the place.
Very good.
Okay.
Thanks, Smith.
Get in touch with me, brother. All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And, gentlemen, I want to thank you both very much. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been a very, very fascinating program for me to do. Not only did I have a wonderful guest, and that was, of course, retired Major Montgomery Granger discussing his book, Surviving Grace at Guantanamo Bay, but I had some wonderful callers. We have been exchanging ideas furiously in the last 40 minutes. I love doing this program because it is a wealth of information. I hope that you learn something as well. I'm going to play us out, but just to remind you, I am back on Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And Tim, my friend Tim Burton, the freedom-loving infidel, will be joining me. And we will be discussing a rather interesting issue, and that is Islam. Is it time to rewrite the immigration book? So please try to tune in for that. Meanwhile, have a blessed weekend, and remember, it is mass Islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all very much. I'll see you on Monday. Thank you.